First of all, how do I pronounce your surname?
Oh, I know, it's a hard one. It's Caligioni.
Caligioni.
Like full okay. Bologna, that's how I remember it.
Because, the hard G, the soft G, I'm not very close to it. Sam Caligioni. Mm-hmm. All right. So, first up, you're based in Delaware,
mm-hmm.
but most of the craft breweries are based on that West Coast. Why, mm-hmm. why do you reckon the West Coast is opposed to the East Coast?
Well, I mean, I think that they came out of the gates earlier. As far as why, I think, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, remember, those are the people that were these pioneers in our country who left the East Coast and kind of traveled across our country to like settling the New West. So I think a lot of Westerners have that in their DNA. They were pioneering spirit people that wanted to strike out on their own and leave Philadelphia and Boston and the old, you know, European settled cities in the U.S. So I think it was just in their nature to say, let's pioneer this industry and create our own breweries. So I think that's really why a lot of it started out there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So and you mentioned, like, when you're brewing, you do, like, kind of, you said more wine-like in your presentation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you said sort of in the context of food. Is that the main thing that you meant? Like, I also write for a magazine, consumer magazine. We do sort of reviews of stuff. And I find that if we can say to people, here's a craft beer, you can serve it with this kind of food, people are more likely to buy it.
Is that context.
Kind of? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're among the first brewers that every piece of our marketing for every beer also had a suggestion of not just what foods it went well with, but also what wines it should replace with your meal. Kind of like if you like, you know, Pinot Gris, you will like our Festina Pesce. And so we worked hard not just to just do the food thing, but to remind people beer is a worthy partner of food, even compared to wine.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you've been traveling the world for Discovery Channel.
Yep, we're doing the show, with them.
And you're making all these weird beers. Do you have Tamarillos in America?
You know, I was talking with Luke about that, and we do. They're starting to get there. They're nowhere as prevalent as the kiwi is in the U.S. But what happened with us was the timing was wrong. It's still, for whatever reason, whatever your harvest season is here in New Zealand, it wasn't available a month and a half or 2 months ago whenever Luke came over to Delaware and we did that batch together. But yes, the Tamarillo is starting to kind of creep into availability in the U.S.
So is that something you think that maybe, you know, you've done the Porto Murillo here, you might do Porto Murillo over there?
Yeah, I mean, we have a pretty fun relationship with the breweries that we collaborate with, where we don't ask for any royalties. Like, we made 7-10 kegs of the beer in the U.S. and then but Luke's gonna sell 600 cases of it. I'm not asking for licensing fees or any percentage of his sales, but what we'll probably say is, hey, you take the southern hemisphere, I'll take the northern hemisphere.
Sweet.
And if this beer's successful and we want to bottle it in the U.S., you say cool with that, and it's just easier. That's what we do with our friends at Sierra Nevada, the breweries that we've collaborated with in Italy. We just say, what region do you think was fair? And we chop the world in two.
Yeah.
And we just say, you take that half of sales and we take the other.
And how much fun is it brewing those ancient beers? I mean, like, I've been reading about the King Midas and the Jaho.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing beers. Was that, like, something that you thought, I really want to do these ancient beers, or did some researcher come to you?
We'd already been doing ancient beers like Sati, which is an ancient, 500-year-old Finland style with rye and junipers. We'd done an African Tej, which I mentioned is made with honey and geisha root. And after we did those, this molecular archaeologist, who's kind of one of the world's foremost experts in ancient beverages, what happened to be based out of University of Pennsylvania in Philly, which is only 2 hours up the road from us. So when he inquired, he called Michael Jackson, the beer writer in London, and said, hey, we've found this, you know, residue on this 3,000-year-old da-da-da-da. And Michael was like, oh, you're in luck. There's a bunch of weirdos right down the road from you in Delaware doing these funky things with raisins and pumpkins. So that's how we got in touch with that science community. But I'd already been brewing these ancient beers just based on my own research and history, but not based on molecular evidence. But those beers, while they're a small percentage of our sales, are a really important part of what we do, because again, they're great reminders to people of what beer used to be is a lot more like what's happening in that room with diversity and choice and complexity than what the global industrialization of the light lager style has driven it to.
Do you find there's a big crossover between the beer geek community and just the general geek community?
Yeah.
You're talking about social media.
Yeah.
Do you find you get like a lot of scientists interested in your ancient beers, but also then go on and try the
other craft beer
and all the rest of it?
Oh, I definitely think so. And I mean, if you go to, like, we're here at Birvana in Wellington, and that room is just like the demographic in a great U.S. Beer festival now, which is, men, women, young people, older people that probably used to drink more wine and discovered craft beer, and younger people who are spending all of their money that they have on craft beer because they love it. 15 years ago when Dogfish was starting, a craft beer festival looked more like a Star Trek convention. It was just like a bunch of 30-year-old dudes in a room together, they're just drinking beer and kind of preaching to the converted. So I think what you've just seen in the last few years is an explosion of the craft brewing audience outside of what we call beer geeks, or I'm a beer geek, just those totally dyed-in-the-wool hardcores that are obsessed with it, to where now it's just maybe foodies have realized it goes well with food, or wine people say, wow, times are tough, I'm not going to buy a $60 bottle of wine, I'll buy a $14 six-pack of craft beer. So, I mean, the audience in the last few years has just kind of really blossomed beyond that initial group of diehard beer geeks.
Cool. Yeah. And last question, because I don't want to keep you. If you could take away a couple of bottles from New Zealand, which ones are you going to take?
Oh, geez, I don't want to...
Because I imagine you're going to take a lot of bottles.
I would. Let me just do stream of consciousness.
Okay,
because
sweet.
Because I don't want to offend any of my friends that I've met down here by not naming them. But obviously, I've been hanging out a lot with Luke, and his barrel-aged stout really impressed me. The Moa sparkling ale that they do with the champagne riddling, the night I had that at Beer vs. Wine. Rich's beers impressed me. From Emerson, I'd say that stout. And I could go on for hours. That rye beer I just had from Renaissance was really nice with the caraway seed. So, the Yeasty Boys beers I've had, that pineapple lump. So, I mean, it's all over the place.
Do you actually find that you go for the, I don't want to say it, but the weirder brews? Because you need something odd.
I would say, I love finding stuff. In the same way that I love brewing things that haven't been brewed in the modern commercial beers world as before, I try and see other beers that have never been done before. And as I said when I was speaking here earlier, not so I can say, I want to do that next, just to see what other people are doing that hasn't been done before. It's like you don't learn from talking, you learn from listening, and you don't really learn much from just trying a derivative, some other blank pale ale. It could be an awesome one, and I'll seek them out. In the case of Emerson's Porter, I don't think they're reinventing the wheel. It's not a super exotic ingredient beer. It's just a really well-made porter, or their Pilsner, or something like that. And I love those beers, too. But yes, probably the first thing I gravitate in the room is a pineapple lump beer, because it's not going to happen in Delaware too often.
Yeah, yeah.
It's my one chance to get it.
Well, you don't even have pineapple, is
it? No, we don't. Luke brought me some, though, so I had tried them before.
Cool. Oh, well, thank you very much.
No, my pleasure.